Reading this morning from 2 Samuel and from Matthew. I'll be reading 2 Samuel chapter 11, verses 1 through 15, and then 26 through 27. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle, David sent Joab with his officers and all of Israel with him. They ravaged the Amorites and besieged Rabbah. But David remained at Jerusalem. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. David sent someone to inquire about the woman. It was reported, "This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam and wife of Uriah the Hittite." So David sent messengers to take her, and she came to him, and he lay with her. Now she was purifying herself after her period. Then she returned to her house. The woman conceived, and she sent and told David, "I am pregnant." So David sent word to Joab, "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent Uriah to David. When Uriah came to him, David asked how Joab and the people fared, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." Uriah went out of the king's house, and there followed him a present from the king. But Uriah slept at the entrance of the king's house with all the servants of the Lord, and did not go down to his own house. When they told David Uriah did not go down to his own house, David said to Uriah, "You have just come from a journey. Why did you not go down to your own house?" Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah all remain in booths in tents, and my lord Joab and the servants of my lord are camping in the open field. Shall I then go down to my house to eat and drink and lie with my wife? As you live and as your soul lives, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to Uriah, "Remain here today also, and tomorrow I will send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day. And on the next day, David invited him to eat and drink in his presence and made him drunk. And in the evening, he went out to lie on his couch with the servants of the Lord. But he did not go down to his own house. In the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it by the hand of Uriah. In the letter he wrote, "Set Uriah in the forefront of the hardest fighting, and then draw back from him so that he may be struck down and die." When the wife of Uriah heard that her husband was dead, she made lamentation for him. When the mourning was over, David sent and brought her to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing that David had done displeased the Lord.
And from the first chapter of Matthew, the genealogy of Jesus. And Boaz, the father of Obed by Ruth, and Obed, the father of Jesse, and Jesse, the father of King David. And King David was the father of Solomon by the wife of Uriah. And Solomon, the father of Rehoboam, and Rehoboam, the father of Abijah, and Abijah, the father of Asaph, and Asaph, the father of Jehoshaphat, and Jehoshaphat, the father of Joram, and Joram, the father of Uzziah, and Uzziah, the father of Jotham, and Jotham, the father of Ahaz, and Ahaz, the father of Hezekiah, and Hezekiah, the father of Manasseh, and Manasseh, the father of Amos, and Amos, the father of Josiah, and Josiah, the father of Jeconiah and his brothers, at the time of the deportation to Babylon. These are our sacred stories.
Thanks be to God.
Thank you.
and Jesse the father of King David, and David was the father of Solomon, whose mother had been Uriah's wife. Uriah's wife. She might as well be the woman with the issue of blood, or the widow who sweeps her house, or Jairus's daughter, or the woman at the well, or the woman caught in adultery, or Noah's wife, or Cain's wife, or the widow of Zarephath, as though there was only one widow of Zarephath, or the wife of Jeroboam, or Peter's mother-in-law, or Jesus's sister, the Syrophoenician woman, or maybe all of those women who get no specific notice at all, who are not even counted. Jesus fed 5,000, not counting women and children. But we know her name. Her name is Bathsheba. Biblical scholar Wilda Gaffney writes that only about 9% of the personal names in the Hebrew Bible belong to women. Only 9%. That's a little more than 100 names. And Bathsheba's is among those few. We know her name. Yet the gospel writer of Matthew, who decides against cultural norms to include women in Jesus' genealogy, does not use her name, and instead identifies her with her dead husband. The gospel writer doesn't use her name, and preachers through the centuries have given her new names, names like adulteress. I mentioned on the first Sunday of Advent seeing these descriptions, from seductive Bathsheba to a woman who received unlimited grace. And in an article entitled The Five Notorious Women in Jesus' Family Tree, she's called Bathsheba, the Master Manipulator. It is past time to change the way Bathsheba's story is told and interpreted, the way it is manipulated. Like with Tamar, the text never suggests that Bathsheba has done anything wrong. The text does not call her adulteress or manipulator. Her story has been used and abused, re-victimizing her through the centuries. We will hear her story. We will say her name. It happened late one afternoon when David rose from his couch and was walking about on the roof of the king's house that he saw from the roof a woman bathing. The woman was very beautiful. So much has been made of Bathsheba being on a roof as though she's an exhibitionist, but the text never says she was on a roof. It says that David was on his roof. He sees Bathsheba, but there's nothing in the text to suggest that she invites his voyeurism or is even aware of it. David sees her and then demands to know who she is. The report comes back. This is Bathsheba, daughter of Eliam and wife of Uriah the Hittite. David would likely find the names of Bathsheba's husband and father familiar. Uriah is listed as one of his 30 mighty men, and Eliam is the son of one of David's counselors. That she has husband and father, that David even knew them, does not stop him. David sent messengers to take her, and then the text says she came to him. This should not imply choice. He was the king. David takes her. He sees her bathing, and he takes her. There's no mention of consent. Choice and autonomy are not part of Bathsheba's story. As Richard Davidson and Did the King David Rape Bathsheba, a case study in narrative theology, points out, once she is taken, there is no one she can appeal to for help or escape. Her screams won't be heard by anyone who would challenge the king in his royal chambers. Davidson continues, this is a power rape in which a person in a position of authority abuses that power to victimize a subservient and vulnerable person sexually, whether or not the victim appears to give consent. David, the king, appointed by God to defend the helpless and vulnerable, becomes a victimizer of the vulnerable. King David takes Bathsheba. He rapes Bathsheba. She returns to her house and later discovers that she is pregnant. Her husband is at war. Her father is at war. There is no one to appeal to for help, no one other than the man who takes. She sends word to David, and David brings Uriah home and tries to get him to have sex with his wife. Out of duty to God and country, Uriah refuses to sleep at home. David's plan for cover-up is destroyed by Uriah's loyalty. David orders Bathsheba's husband to the front lines so that he will be killed by enemy soldiers. And once Uriah is confirmed dead, David takes Bathsheba as his wife. David takes and takes. This is a violent story. The whole episode is set against the backdrop of war. In the spring of the year, the time when kings go out to battle. But David, after dispatching his general Joab and all of his officers and regiments, remained at Jerusalem. While his troops are ravaging the Amorites and besieging the city of Raba, King David sets out to ravage and besiege the married Bathsheba. He objectifies and takes her, and then has her husband murdered. And through all of this, he doesn't see that he's done anything wrong. If we'd kept reading during the scripture lesson, we would have heard the prophet Nathan confront David. The Lord sent Nathan to David, and he said to him, "There were two men in a certain city, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had very many flocks and herds, but the poor man had nothing but one little ewe lamb, which he had bought. He brought it up, and it grew up with him and his children, and it used to eat his meager fare and drink from his cup and lie in his bosom, and it was like a daughter to him. Now there came a traveler to the rich man, and he was loath to take one of his own flock or herd to prepare for the wayfarer who had come to him. But he took the poor man's lamb and prepared that for the guest who had come to him. Then David's anger was greatly kindled against the man. He said to Nathan, 'As the Lord lives, the man who has done this deserves to die. He shall restore the lamb fourfold because he did this thing and because he had no pity.' Nathan said to David, 'You are the man.'" In order for David to come to realize what he has done to Bathsheba, to another human being, Nathan must compare her to a beloved pet. David can understand the value of a lamb, but he fails to understand the value and the autonomy and the personhood of a woman. He's ready to convict this wealthy landowner for taking the lamb of the poor man, but he takes Bathsheba without another thought, except for the cover-up. His culture has taught him, perhaps demanded of him, a disregard for the lives of women, the voices of women, the autonomy of women. Oh, how I wish his culture were more different from our own. Fellow Alliance of Baptist Minister Kendall Rothaus, in an article entitled "Christian Feminist Response to Baylor," she writes, "We've taught our sons and our daughters that women do not really know what they want, that their opinions are invalid, and their voices are not worth hearing. It should not surprise us that administrators reportedly engaged in victim blaming. We've been blaming Eve since the beginning of time, and we've not yet repented our slander. We've taught ourselves to ignore the voices, stories, and desires of women. And such rejection of any woman's inherent worth and equality leads to devastating results. Women have been burned at the stake, ravaged by men, and used as property for centuries." Stories matter. How we read them matters. that we hear them matters. Stories from our biblical text are woven into the fabric of our lives and often inform our thoughts about worth and value. Stories harness power. When we teach our children and our youth to identify harmful systems of abuse in our biblical texts, we help them to recognize and to call out injustices in their current realities. Erica Hewitt in The Dynamics of Silence proclaims, "We're unraveling silence because we've determined that our power with one another is greater than the power someone once had over us." There is power in solidarity, power with one another, power in hearing and believing. Bathsheba has a name, and it is not adulterous. It is not seductive. It is not master manipulator. Her story should make us angry. Angry that she is taken, and angry that while she is not a manipulator, her story has been manipulated, has been told by the church as her shame. We cannot stop with anger. We must use our anger for courage, courage to unravel silence and shame. It has taken and is taking our voices to create change. With so many willing to risk so much to share stories of sexual violence, women and men are gaining courage from solidarity. It has taken and is taking thousands of voices for believing the victim to begin to become the first response. We are seeing a shift, however slowly, toward believing, toward listening rather than doubting, blaming, and shaming. We still have so long to go. The stories are in us and among us, ready to be heard and shared, ready to be believed. The thread finds a way. You may write me down in history with your bitter, twisted lies. You may tread me to the very dirt, but still, like dust, I'll rise. Bathsheba's story does not end with this episode. Again, unlike so many women in the Bible who get a verse or a paragraph and then are never heard from again, Bathsheba returned to the narrative when King David is old and dying. David's son, Adonijah, is trying to take the throne instead of Solomon, Bathsheba's son, to whom David has promised the throne. Bathsheba goes to David and demands that he secure Solomon's place. David does as Bathsheba instructs, and Solomon does indeed become the next king. Bathsheba, the woman who was taken and raped, Bathsheba, whose husband was murdered to cover up David's sin. Bathsheba, who has no choice but to marry her rapist. Bathsheba reclaims what has been stolen. She uses her voice to speak out for her son. We can assume she's been using her voice long before now, but the Bible gives us none of that. It seems only concerned with her words to the man in power. But Solomon, at least, has heard her long before now. He knows her to be a woman of great wisdom. When Solomon is crowned as king, he seats his mother on the throne next to his. In 1 Kings 2:19, we read, "Then King Solomon rose to meet Bathsheba and bowed down to her. Then he sat on his throne and had a throne brought for the king's mother, and she sat on his right." Anger and courage and voice. May Bathsheba inspire us to listen, to believe. May she inspire us to tell the stories that must be given voice, to speak out and speak up. Surely this is the way to Advent peace. Amen.